WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at fairtoflare.com. And we're here today talking about the SummerSlam 2010, Team WWE against Team Nexus. This is our last installment of the SummerSlam main event series. And my special guest returning to the show is Trey Irby of Wrestling Theory. Trey, how are you doing today?
Pretty well, but more importantly, SmackDown is coming to Sci-Fi.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. And this show was a great reminder of that fact. They really wanted us to know that it was coming to Sci-Fi. So yay.
They really want us to know that. They want us to know that Kane probably caused his brother's vegetative state.
Yes.
Probably.
Perhaps. Yes.
Not that 5'2" guy. I mean, it's really weird how. Who would think that Rey Mysterio would do such a vile action?
Yeah.
Such a short guy.
I know. Yeah, short guys never commit crimes or do anything bad. Yeah.
They never do. Except yep. Daniel Bryan, which adds to this subject.
Exactly. Yeah. So the official teams, we'll list them off, are John Cena, Chris Jericho, Edge, R-Truth, John Morrison, Bret Hart, and a mystery seventh member. Against Wade Barrett, David Otunga, Heath Slater, Skip Sheffield, Darren Young, Michael Tarver, and Justin Gabriel. So the original seven Nexus against Team WWE. And it was kind of interesting how this whole Nexus deal came along. I mean, obviously they had the really hot debut in early June when they all, the seven of those and also Daniel Bryan, the original eight Nexus, I guess, all attacked John Cena and CM Punk, although mostly John Cena, in a main event of Raw, destroying the set, and of course the infamous tie joking incident from Daniel Bryan on Justin Roberts, but just a really chaotic, fascinating angle that just really was something that had never really been seen in WWE before.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It was the type of thing where I don't know how much you add to, like, the original attack to the point where, you know, almost everyone that's a current wrestling fan has seen the attack. So it's not like you can be like, well, that's really good, that viciousness that they caused. But I think it summed it up. I remember looking at an article on, like, TV Tropes, one of those type of sites, that summed it up as it managed to make eight rookies, five of which were completely uninteresting on the show NXT, and suddenly into, you know, interesting figures in maybe 10 minutes when they, you know, spent 4 months on them.
Yeah, and really spent 4 months making them less interesting as the weeks went on, as NXT kind of went from sort of an interesting concept into sort of just like an embarrassing contest show where they had to do silly things and were made fun of most of the time and mostly made to look dumb. I mean, I think Wade Barrett did get some benefit out of the exposure from that show.
Wade did, and maybe to an extent Daniel Bryan, only because, well, even though they did the really stupid thing of being like, he's a really good wrestler, let's make him lose 12 times for the duration of the show. But then, like, the whole feud with Cole, the whole thing with that, it in a weird way, even though it wasn't a very good show, it kind of, you know, shifted things to where we are now.
Yeah, there was some interesting experimentation on that show. They tried some different things. I think you're definitely right. The Brian Cole standoff, kind of with the beginning of the Michael Cole heel character, which had definitely had its good and its bad points, but was really fascinating on that show for a while. And, you know, some other things. I really do think, even though that show was mostly a mess, there really were some memorable things that kind of came out of it.
There was also kind of this weird emphasis to where NXT now I found a lot better than NXT Season 1 then. Because at least in a sense, even though, you know, it's obviously a rigged contest show, they at least make it a little more clear to where, you know, like the only highlight of Season 1 I remember other than, you know, the Brian Cole stuff was any time that Brian and The Miz would, like, communicate outside in the ring, and Brian would be like, yeah, I'm better than you as a wrestler. And Miz would be like, no, you're not. And then, like, and William Regal and CM Punk would be sitting in their pros chairs being like, no, yeah, he is. No, yeah, he is. Like,
yeah.
I think the high point of it actually was CM Punk mouthing at one point, by a mile at some point. It was wonderful, wonderful stuff.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah. Now, of course, the big beginning here is that Miz comes out and he wants to be the seventh guy, and kind of the whole thing is that the team WWE was not able to get along. It was a mix of the good guys and the bad guys, and they had a really cool, like, first angle where, you know, sort of Cena, like, assembled the team and they all came out, and then the final guy to come out was Bret Hart, who just got, like, this giant reaction. It was first time Bret had been on TV in a few months, and, you know, it was kind of like all these guys, you know, uniting together to face off against the Nexus, and they all kind of ran into the ring and chased Nexus off. And this was after Nexus had pretty much repeatedly, you know, run roughshod and, you know, beaten guys down for a while, and for the most part, I thought the first two and a half months of the Nexus thing was really strong. There might have been a couple weeks where they weren't exactly sure how to handle the Nexus.
There's a few weeks where they definitely were kind of like, where there would just be 10 minutes, Michael Tarver and Skip Sheffield promos, and you're kind of like, I don't know about this.
Yeah, I mean, they were just trying to figure it out. But they did a good job of not letting them show too much vulnerability.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, they were, you know, presented as, you know, pretty tough, you know, guys, and, you know, it didn't all exactly make sense if you really thought too much about it, but if you didn't think too much about it, which I think is how WWE wants it, then, you know, it worked pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So then, so Miz comes out and wants to be seventh guy, and then Cena tells him that they couldn't wait, and so they have Daniel Bryan come out, and of course he had...
Complete with awesome generic rock music that he dropped like 3 weeks later.
Yes, yes. He completely... and gets a really big reaction to coming out, and you know, he of course had been... he'd been fired after the initial Nexus attack that we referenced with choking out Justin Roberts in a non-PG way. And also, I guess, you know, the hearkening to, you know, some of the Chris Benoit nastiness too. So,
icky memory.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly good month for anything.
No, exactly not. So he was back and got a big reaction, and then pretty much immediately comes in and then makes Darren Young submit in only 45 seconds. So, you know, kind of very quickly.
Weirder. I was interrupting. It was kind of weirder to me that even in like the two and a half months that they're really dominant, they really made Darren Young kind of look not very good. Like, he was definitely the weak link of the team from the start.
Yeah, well, like, I guess you kind of have to have a guy who was a weak link for the team, so to speak. But one thing I did like in the build up to this, in that last few months, I thought that the team WWE infighting was pretty interesting, although it might have gotten a little excessive. But I liked the final, you know, like, okay, now, you know, we've overcome these differences and now we're sort of together. I thought that was pretty cool. And then they did a 7-on-7 with these guys, with the Nexus guys, against another group of 7 WWE. But basically, not exactly like complete jokes, but mostly guys, you know, who were, you know, jobber level or lower mid card guys, and they were able to win.
Or Jerry
like,
Lawler.
7-0. Oh yeah, that's right. Lawler was in that
group. Or Jerry Lawler.
Yeah, that's right.
The other one. Well, it'd be like Lawler, Henry, and like Yoshi Tatsu, and
right.
Primo, yeah. And others.
Yeah, and I thought that was a really effective, just, you know, it's like, wow, we're just going to make them strong and make them look good, and I thought that was really good. So,
They really set up the whole idea of, like even, like, the opening entrance, which I thought was really interesting, was that the Nexus comes out, and they come out together. that basically every angle beforehand, they didn't lose because they're united together.
Yes.
And that they, like, all seven of them come out, and then all the Team WWE guys come out to their separate entrances.
Right.
Presumably because Chris Jericho did not want to come out to John Cena's music all that badly.
Yeah, yeah.
And Michael Cole notes about Bret Hart in this match. He goes, he's really the heart and soul of this team.
Ah, yes.
Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Well, Michael Cole is not exactly, you know, commentary gold, let's say. It's weird hearing him because he's basically the good guy cheerleader here. I mean, he questions Daniel Bryan's ability. Like, he keeps saying, like, Daniel Bryan was a mistake to be on the team. But it's not like he's actively rooting against Bryan. He's actively rooting for the good guys.
He's actively rooting for the good guys. But at the same time, this also leading to, like, the amazing Cole and Stryker arguments. This is one of the I guess this is the only SummerSlam where Matt Stryker is calling the main event.
Which, wow, yeah.
Thankfully, that might not have happened too many other times. But he had some pretty good quotes.
Okay.
He had some pretty good ones. Like, when we look back at history, we'll see what kind of legacy these seven newcomers leave in the WWE.
Yes.
Well,
I liked it was later in the match, but amidst the three of them kind of all bickering with each other, finally it's Cole, Lawler, and Stryker, and Stryker says, "Stop, this is what the Nexus wants, divisions among the announcers."
Yeah, because the Nexus really wants commentary to be divided.
Yes, because that's totally going to kill the morale of the guys in the ring if the commentators aren't all on the same page. So I like that, yeah.
And then others would be like, guys, WWE's been challenged in the past. NWO, three guys. ECW, a lot of guys in the 1990s. The Alliance, a lot more than seven guys. But nothing like these seven guys in the Nexus.
Yeah. Well, you know, everything that's happening now is the biggest thing that's happening. That's a wrestling rule. So,
indeed.
Yeah. I'll just go through a couple of the how the eliminations went real quick, and then we'll kind of go into more details toward the last third of the match or so. We have Morrison. He pins Tarver with the Starship Pain. Then Skip Sheffield comes and beats him up, and then Morrison gets kicked in the head from Gabriel, and then Sheffield does the really strong running clothesline of Morrison for the pin. And then Sheffield beats R-Truth with a running clothesline just 30 seconds later. So
they really did a lot to build up Skip in that match in particular. I mean, he's kind of was built up as, like, the big hoss, the big guy of the team that, you know, his purpose is power. But they did, like, a hell of a lot to make him look particularly strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really did a strong job with him, I thought. And then Bret Hart comes in and really looks really good.
He did a lot of, you know, obviously basic maneuvers, but, like, it was basic maneuvers that were really well executed.
Everything was crisp, and his movement looked really good. I mean, it was just basically punches, atomic drop. He went for the sharpshooter, you know, just the basic stuff. But he really did, it was nice to see him look so good after the, you know, WrestleMania match with Vince, where it was just kind of a huge debacle.
Yeah.
And I know he did his best there, but at least, like, it was nice for him to have this moment. And, you know, Bret's a guy who you look back at SummerSlam performances and he's, you know, up there when it comes to all-time performers at SummerSlam. I mean, maybe he doesn't have as many great performances as Shawn Michaels has at WrestleMania, but it's, you know, it's not like it's out of the ballpark, you know?
I mean, I guess it's kind of a good nod to SummerSlam 92 that that Bret Hart's facing off against a team headed by a British guy.
There you go, exactly. I bet they were thinking that, too.
Oh, they totally were thinking that, which is why they had a group of multi-ethnic team members with each other. The Nexus is really a good UN, if you will. You know,
not too bad.
Britain,
yeah.
South Africa... Where the fuck David Otunga is from.
Yeah, America,
where,
I believe. But
Wherever, America. Well, Otunga, Sheffield, and Tarver and Young are from the United States of America.
Okay. Well,
allegedly.
Sure.
And I guess Heath Slater's from... no one considers the South a part of America. And I'm saying that as a member of the South.
Yeah. Well, so it's just whatever. If there's an alternate universe where the Confederacy won or something. Hopefully not. That wouldn't be a good alternate universe. But anyway, let's move on. Brett gets disqualified after he uses the chair on Skip Sheffield to get him out of the match. And people are pretty upset when he's out because people really were into Brett during this match, which is nice to see, you know. Because I thought there was some of the time when Brett came back where the crowd just didn't really connect with him as much. And I think maybe just because of either the younger audience or, Brett's limitations as a performer at this point after his stroke and everything. But I thought but it was nice to see him really get his due here from the crowd.
Yeah, good deal. It probably helps also that they're in Los Angeles. So it would seem like for some reason it seems like the big cities, L.A. and New York, they really have more insider crowds. I guess that sounds kind of dumb. But, more fans that, like, remember history and whatnot. And
yeah, maybe. I don't know. That's interesting. Well, they
cheered huge for Brian coming out. And I'd imagine that not too – I mean, they had, like, the angle that justified and all that. But I can't imagine there were too many people also that were going to be, like – that I'm sure there were a lot of people would be like, holy crap, Daniel Bryan's here. The American Dragon has arrived at SummerSlam, and so on.
Yeah. And then Sheffield's eliminated, but after he gets a codebreaker from Jericho and then a spear from Edge. So really, he took a lot of punishment to be eliminated from the match. They really were pushing him strong. I kind of forgot. And obviously he got hurt not long after this and was, and it hasn't been back. He apparently has had issues with his ankles, had to have several surgeries. So you wonder, whether he'll be able to make it back, but, they really were behind him at this point. So,
yeah.
And then eventually Jericho uses the Lion Salt on Otunga and makes him tap to the Walls of Jericho. So the babyfaces have a pretty good advantage here. But then Jericho runs into Cena, and then Slater pins Jericho from behind. And then Edge is upset at Cena for costing Jericho the fall, which is funny because that Edge and Jericho are on the same page after they had that big WrestleMania feud. I mean, Edge obviously a term, but it's always funny when guys like it's like, oh, that's now forgotten because we're both on the same side. We're both bad guys now. So
I like that. I also like that there were kind of two little nods. One was that Jericho, for one point during this, awesome heel run of his, he really got to play babyface, and like the crowd was like going crazy. They were like, Y2J, like, and he was a really good babyface. As it turns out, Chris Jericho is a pretty good wrestler on both sides.
That's what I've heard. Yeah.
And then the second thing I realized was up to this point, Heath Slater was Chris Jericho's Achilles heel. Because he also lost the he also had like a big upset that he lost to Heath Slater on NXT.
That's right.
So at this point in his career, Chris Jericho's kryptonite was the one-man rock band Heath Slater.
Yeah. I guess Jericho's kryptonite is red instead of green, but
it fits. So.
Yes. So we have so eventually Slater, as Edge is arguing with Cena, then Slater comes and pins Edge as well with a roll up. So we've got we've got Edge upset. He actually spears. He spears both Cena and Jericho, and so everyone's sort of just kind of really angry at each other. And at this
point, Daniel Bryan's busy trying to make sure that everyone stays together.
Yeah, he's trying to be the peacemaker. Yeah, he's he's the good guy there. So now we're down to Cena and Bryan against Barrett and Slater and Gabriel, 2-on-3, and we're about 20 minutes into the match at this point. So this
really
is
good first 20 minutes too. It was really like it transitioned really well. We'll get into this obviously as it goes on, but
yeah.
It's not as awesome as it heads towards the end, but
yeah, but it's structured well. I mean, they did really, it's laid out very well. It's interesting. Like there's no really dead point in the match. I mean, even, after this point you have, they're kind of all taking turns on Cena, and Cena is he's the face in peril for quite a lengthy period of time during the match, which is interesting because I would have thought that's, I don't know, I would have thought Brian would have been a better choice for that, and then him teasing it to Cena, both because Cena's more over and because Brian's, you know, ability to do that. But, I mean, it worked out fine the other way, too. Eventually, Brian's able to make a fiery comeback. He basically destroys Heath Slater and hits him with a suicide dive, follows with a missile dropkick. He gets a double dropkick on Barrett and Gabriel when they're in the corner, and Slater tries to do a roll-up, but then Brian reverses it into his crossface, or what's that move?
Lebel lock.
Lebel lock. Thank you. Yes.
We can't call it the crossface.
Right.
That would
right.
be too detrimental. Yeah.
Yes. And then is able to make him tap. So I thought that was a really good sequence. And then sort of Brian stands and he's challenging one of the other two guys to come in to fight him. But then Miz sneaks from behind. And I guess the referee's attention is either on Cena, who was selling the beating, or on, you know, something else. But then he clobbers Brian with the briefcase, and then Barrett gets the pin. So I thought that was good. You know, that obviously set up Miz and or essentially renewed Miz and Bryan's issues, which led to their really cool U.S. title feud, and was a good way to showcase Bryan, but then getting him out of the match for, you know, the final part of the story.
Yeah.
And at that point, Cena, you know, gets beaten on for a little bit, but then he makes his usual comeback. And the fans are pretty into him. There aren't many boos. There was definitely a point when Cena was getting beat on earlier where there was a "Let's go, Cena, Cena sucks" chant. But for the most part, I would say that people are into this storyline at this point, this, you know, WWE Nexus storyline. They're not really acting like they normally do in a Cena match, where, you know, a large segment of the fans ignores the storyline and goes with, you know, with whatever they want to go with.
Yeah, I suppose that I found it really interesting you brought up the point about Cena not being having to play babyface in peril. I think when we head on towards like the ending sequence, I'm starting to realize that maybe that's also a bit backwards considering the finish.
Okay.
Yeah, I just feel like, but yeah, basically, at this point, it's basically the 2-on-1 Gabriel and Barrett just taking down Slater. I mean, not Slater, Cena.
Right.
Heath Slater of Team WWE.
Yes. So yeah, then Cena gets the five knuckle shuffle, and then he tries the attitude adjustment, but then Barrett gets the tag, and Barrett pounds on Cena, and then lands a big boot that sends him outside. And then they make like a really big show of they pull up the padding on the mat, and they expose the concrete, and then there's a and then like the crowd's like kind of getting hushed, and like, you know, Lawler in particular is like speaking in hushed tones, like, oh no, they need to stop this, and, you know, and so forth. And then Barrett lands like a pretty vicious DDT on the concrete, and everyone's kind of grim about it. And then they, you know, they dump Cena in, and then Gabriel teases the 450, and then he misses it, and then Cena sort of like sneaks and gets the pin, and Cena plays dead for a while, and then as Barrett goes after him, Cena, you know, springs up right away, lulls Barrett into the STF, and then wins the match. So, I don't know.
It was a pretty – well, I also had heard that most of the reason why that Cena did his typical – typical, I guess, if you're smart, Cena no-sell and sudden win a match – was because they were running really short on time. It was really, really late in the show.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, oh, crap, what do we do? Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it was a 35-minute match. I mean, yeah, you know, ideally, you know, you would have him sell that DDT longer. I mean, you can sort of justify the – you can sort of justify him like rolling out of the other way on the shooting star press, a 450 splash, and then and then getting that quick pin, and then maybe like Barrett pounds on him for a while, and you do a few more minutes, and then Cena wins. But you know, you mean wrestling? Sometimes these things happen. I didn't think it was nearly as bad as some other people thought it was, as far as, you know, being ridiculously stupid. But I will acknowledge that, yeah, if a guy takes a DDT on the concrete, he should probably, you know, be hurt for longer than Cena was.
He should probably be hurt for longer than maybe about 5 minutes.
Exactly. More like 2 minutes, honestly. But
you're thinking about like the great era of like, you know, a lot of, you know, early 90s WCW angles where like he hit a DDT on the concrete. We will not see him for another 6 weeks.
Exactly. Yes. That's more of the wrestling that I like. But, you know, it's changed. They don't do that so much anymore and so forth. But it's a really I thought the match overall was effective. Having Team WWE win was sort of a strange decision at this point, just because it felt like Nexus, that the idea is that they win here and then you build to like the big Barrett Cena singles match with something like on the line. Like in retrospect, honestly, I think it would have been cool if they would have had the Cena has to work with Nexus storyline if he loses here, and then spend a few months with that rather than rushing it like they did. But probably didn't come up with it till later. So
I feel like with the Nexus in general, though, there was kind of like the three acts of eventual insignificance. Because, like, there's this first act where the Nexus is entirely badass. They rule the entire promotion and all that. Mm-hmm. And then this sort of just climaxes here. Then we have act two where they're kind of still badass. And, you know, they get the win over John Cena. And John Cena has to be a member of the Nexus. And then that sort of ends with the Survivor Series match. And then we have act three where it's CM Punk and four lackeys. For lack of a better term.
Yeah. Yeah, they really... they did sort of pick up the momentum back again a couple weeks after the SummerSlam. Like, you know, we're kind of building to the match where Cena had to, join Nexus if he lost. And then, of course, he lost. But then after that point, it really just was basically Cena destroying and embarrassing Nexus every week without really... getting the kind of heat that you need to get to sort of justify that, to make that interesting, you know? And there were so many really holes in that story, and they seemed to lose interest and lose faith behind, you know, the Nexus guys. I mean, even eventually Wade Barrett, who really seemed like a guy who was going to launch into superstardom. And it's certainly not over for him by any means. I mean, he's in a decent position now. He's Intercontinental title level. I mean, you know, he may just get a couple more years of seasoning and they may have big things for him again. Or, you know, he might be in line for a title shot soon. He might be in the next main event program. Who knows? WWE will, you know, sometimes just randomly pick guys. And, you know, as long as he improves and is, and shows obviously what he can do on the microphone, he's a very good talker. I think he'll be fine. I'm not really sure any of the other Nexus guys, really are going to do a whole lot more than they have.
I'm afraid Darren Young's probably, I mean, I haven't minded his work on NXT Redemption this season, but they don't seem like they're particularly high on him.
Yeah, Slater and Gabriel have been a solid tag team, and you know that's fine for them. Maybe they could do something more. You never know. But it does feel like. It does feel like overall there was a big opportunity that was lost here. That, you know, just with the initial stages of the Nexus thing, they really could have had something just incredibly special, and it just didn't work out, and they kind of blew through it. And honestly, I mean, the parallels to the Invasion are really there. I mean, they're really...
Oh, absolutely.
That was kind of... You know, people were always like, well, I mean, obviously the initial angle... was really stronger than almost anything they did during the Invasion, but
was that ECW angle that they did where after, you know, the 2 months of WCW, you know, being on the show and everybody being like, oh, and they had like, you know, Lance Storm and a few others, we'll say Rhino, Rob Van Dam, all attack people that Raw in, oddly enough, I believe in June 2001.
Yes. I think you're right. Yeah, I guess there was that. I wasn't that was sort of a that was sort of like a hot shot, like let's do 6 months worth of storyline in one night kind of thing. So I kind of consider that a little bit of cheating. Like, you know, you can almost, you can do anything, you can make anything hot if you really, you know, I don't know, set the conditions that way, so to speak, where, you know, there was, I mean, this, that was the Nexus first angle was definitely a one night, like, incredible thing, you know, and it was one night's worth of storyline, too.
Well, I guess you could actually argue, though, that admittedly, they did kind of, in their weird, silly way, they did kind of do the reverse of that, because if you look at the first season of NXT as ribbing all the members of the Nexus, then this was a four-month storyline. Then this was a four-month build to a payoff.
Okay.
I'd like, because I guess you could say, like, the way that, like, all these people, like, all the members of the Nexus, like, you know, hated management, and, you know, it would take, you know, you'd have to, it'd take a lot of explaining, I guess, and all that, you know, and a lot of, basically a lot of fan wank, for lack of a better term, but
sure,
you could get there.
Yeah, I mean, I've, clearly the motivation for the characters was that they had been embarrassed and humiliated on NXT, and they were, you know, and they felt they were ready and justified and belonged in the WWE. And, you know, and that obviously, that probably wasn't the intention of NXT, but it did, it was a nice way to build to that. I'll certainly agree with that. So,
yeah. Alas, the two, oh, also, Matt Stryker, while I'm thinking about the three acts of insignificance, Matt
sure.
Stryker had all three of his moment, big moments, all of them failing moments, be in all three of those acts, including
okay.
the famous Cena's free.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
And then by the time that we get to now, he's hosting NXT, and that's all he's done doing.
Yeah, well.
Poor Matt.
Poor Matt Stryker, yeah. Couldn't happen to a better guy, I guess. Okay, well, anything else you wanted to bring up about the match or the feud?
Not particularly.
Okay.
I think we pretty well got it covered.
Cool.
I think we got it covered.
Why don't you tell everybody about Wrestling Theory and plug anything you want to plug?
I suppose to sum it up, it's just, you know, a fun little Tumblr blog. Sometimes it's fun. Sometimes people are like, you're really thinking too seriously about stuff. Social issues should not be brought up in blogs or whatever. but there is, like, the thing I will plug, the site is wrestlingtheory.tumblr.com. The thing I do really want to plug is there is an ebook on one of the top links of the site called Bindings. And if you want to have, like, kind of a primer of, like, what, you know, my serious writing or whatever actually seems like, go ahead. Just follow the instructions and whatnot. 47 pages. K. Sawyer Paul likes it. That's an endorsement, right?
Yeah, he's a smart guy. He has good taste.
He knows his stuff. So yeah, if you want to do that, it's free. You know, just right click and whatnot. It's fun stuff.
Cool. All right, Trey. Well, thanks a lot for being on the show again, and always appreciate it. And thanks everyone for listening. This is the final chapter of our SummerSlam main event series. So hope you enjoyed. Yes, hope you enjoyed the shows, and keep checking out WrestleSpective.com and FairToFlare.com for all of your wrestling needs. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Let's be honest. Most wrestling websites suck. BS rumors, schoolyard gossip, plagiarism. It's no wonder why no one believes anything they read on the internet. Well, if you can't get something done right, you might as well do it yourself. Presenting the Fair to Flare Quarterly from the writers of FairToFlare.com and over a dozen other wrestling websites. We're not copy and pasting what we read in some newsletter. This is 100% original content from the best wrestling bloggers on the internet. In-depth analysis of the art of pro wrestling, debate, artwork, and humor. The Fair to Flare Quarterly will raise the bar of what wrestling journalism can and should be. Professionally edited and produced, and every contributor will be paid for their work. Order your copy of the Fair to Flare Quarterly today at FairToFlare.com. The better wrestling media has arrived.